what this session's going to be on is on terminology. And terminology that deals with the festivals, but terminology that we find especially in the Gospels and the Epistles. And I titled this Back to the Future. Everybody knows that movie. But to get started, I want to go to the prologue of Canterbury Tales. And the prologue of Canterbury Tales was written in what we call Middle English. Middle English, and it starts off one that opera with his shirt sota, the dork, the morcha, presto, the rota, and bother every vantage, wish, liqueur, which virtute engendered le fleur. And it goes on. That was English from several hundred years ago. And none of us would recognize that as English today. And so let's go on very quickly. You know, back to the Back to the Future movie, we have this scene where the guy comes in, Morty comes into the soda fountain, to the drugstore. And the guy says, "Are you going to order something, kid?" And he says, "Yeah, give me a tab." Now he's gone from the 1980s to the 1950s. And the man says, "A tab? I can't give you a tab unless you order something." And so Morty says, "Right, give me a Pepsi Free." And he says, "You want a Pepsi Free? You're going to pay for it." So he says, "Well, give me something sugar-free." So he gives him black coffee. Okay? He said everything right, but he didn't communicate because the meanings had changed. We have a bigger problem when we talk about the Scriptures. In the English language, we have the English language, but the lawyers have a language. The doctors have a language. There's a computer language. We have our phones have languages. I don't understand this at all. Apps. I have no apps on my phone because I don't know how to do it. And I don't know how to tell somebody I don't know how to do it because they don't understand what I'm saying when I talk. Okay? So, in the New Testament, it wasn't written in Greek. We know that. That's obvious. Aramaic, that was the big theory a few years ago. But Aramaic, we know now, it has a lot of loan words that come from Aramaic. But the language that was spoken in Judea, in the Galilee, in Perea, in the Decapolis, was Hebrew by the Jews. And so we had not only Hebrew, you can know Hebrew, but you can have it with a Western mindset. This is frequently the problem when you read books, Jewish books, that were written by American Jews or European Jews that are so assimilated that they have the European or the Western mindset. Okay? So you have to have the Eastern mindset. But we have three more primary languages that the New Testament was spoken and written in. So these are an agricultural language. It was an agricultural society. And so references will be done over and over from the agricultural aspect. The temple from Yehezkel or Ezekiel chapter 43 and verse 11. It says, "If they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the temple and its arrangement. Its exits, its entrances, its entire design." The word that you have here for design is tafnit. It means a blueprint. "All its ordinances, all its forms, and all its laws, write it down in their sight so that they may keep its whole design and all its ordinances and perform them." Then we have festivals and Shabbat. For this language, what I'm talking about is that the temple has a terminology that is central to the temple. Agriculture has a terminology that is central to not only agriculture, but agriculture in lieu of the commandments. Agriculture in lieu of Israel itself. We have the festivals. And we're going to go through a lot of the terminology that deal with the festivals. But our main sources, of course, are going to be the Hebrew Tanakh. The New Testament. When you have the New Testament, you have it in English, or maybe Spanish, or another language. And then generally what people will do is take it back to the Greek. You have to take it back past the Greek. You have to go back to the Hebrew. And you have to look at it to try to figure it out in that context, because the Greek context is Western. It's not Middle Eastern. Main source. I want you to go in your Bible, please, to 1 Chronicles, chapter 28. We're going to go to verse 11. It says, "Then David gave his son Shlomo," or Solomon, "the plans for the festival." It's talking about the temple. It means the porch of the temple. Its houses, its treasuries, its upper chambers, its inner chambers, and the place of the mercy seat. All the plans. Again, the word that you have here where it says plans is this Hebrew word tavnit. "For all that he had by the Spirit of the courts of the house of the Lord, of all the chambers all around, of the treasures of the house of God, the treasures for the dedicated things, also for the division of the priest and the Levites, for all the work of the service of the house of the Lord, and for all the articles of the service in the house of the Lord." Now, I want to go back to one phrase in here. It says, "For all the work of the service of the house of the Lord." For all the work of the service of the house of the Lord. In Hebrew, the word is avodah. The avodah, the services. The services did not come from the priest. The services of the temple did not come from the rabbis. The services for the temple came from God to King David. And David received these. We read in verse 19. It says, "All this said David, the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me." In the temple, you didn't just stroll in and go over to see what you wanted to see. When you walked in the temple, there was a way that you walked. You entered from a certain direction through a certain gate, and you would come from the south. And you would come through a tunnel. When you would come out of the tunnel, you go to the right. And you will make a circuit around, and you will exit going out this way. If you are in mourning or you have an impurity, you go to the left and you go in that direction. To go to any courtyard, there is a way that you go. You don't just stroll in and just go over here. In the temple, you do not come in and start praying. You pray certain prayers. These prayers came from God. They came from Hashem. And you prayed them at certain times. You did not go in and say, a psalm for a day, I'm going to pick a psalm. Only certain psalms were done on certain days in the temple. What I'm trying to say is the liturgy came from God. The liturgy did not come from the rabbis. So the liturgy is one of your main sources, one of your main places that you go to understand what are the expressions, what are the themes that relate to the various festivals. And so we have, besides the liturgy, and of course you have the daily liturgy, you have the Shabbat liturgy, and then you have a liturgy for each of the festivals, as well as every ceremony that you have, such as the red heifer, the leper, the cleansing of the leper, the woman that's accused of adultery. All of these things have a liturgy that is associated with it. So where do we find these sources? We find them out of what's called the Mishnah, the Tosafta, and the two editions of the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. We find also what is out of the Apocrypha. We'll find some of the expressions, some of the terminology. The Apocrypha is not part of Scripture. Understand that Mishnah is not part of Scripture, Tosafta or Talmud. But these are going to be sources that you'll draw this information from. The Pseudepigrapha. One of the greatest sources is like First Enoch. It is full of expressions that deal with these languages. The agricultural, the temple, and the festivals. Josephus and Philo give us our historical references. Before we do this, I want to go up here. No, let's do this one. All of you know the story of when Yeshua is being tried. And we have, it's in three of our Gospels, but Yeshua is being tried. Before this, he said to Shimon or to Peter, he said, "Surely I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." We have a problem with this. Our problem is that you cannot raise poultry in Jerusalem when the temple is standing. It was against the law. It dealt with the laws of purity. If you cannot have poultry, you cannot have roosters. If you cannot have roosters, then we have a problem. Was Yeshua mistaken? Or did that law not exist? What's happening here? Here, let me read this to you real quick. It says, "One may not raise small cattle in Eretz Israel," means the land of Israel, "but one may raise them in Syria and in the wilderness," or the deserts, in Eretz Israel. Syria, by the way, it was considered, halakhically, was considered a part of the land of Israel. Because Israel, at the time of King David and King Solomon, had extended, including Syria. "One may not raise fowl at Jerusalem because of the sacrifices, nor priest in Eretz Israel, because of richly clean foods." We're going to go on. The word for chicken in Hebrew is gever. G-E-V-E-R, gever. The word for crier in the temple is gever. G-E-V-E-R. This is from the Talmud Yerushalmi 6:1. It says, "Gevini," and the Gevini comes from the word gever. Gevini is the herald, is the crier. "For he made an announcement in the temple." What did he say? "Let the priest arise for the sacred service, the Levites for the singing on the platform, on the dukkan, and the Israelites for their designation as the counterpart to the region's priesthood undertaking the labor of sacrificial service in the given week." King Agrippa heard his voice from 8 parsangs, gave him many gifts, ben gever. Ben gever is a title, means the son of the crier, is in charge of closing the gates. Rav interpreted before the house of Rabbi Shila the language the cock crowed as the spokesman proclaimed. They said to him, "Say the cock crowed." He said to them, "It is in accord with what we have learned, ben gever. Can you say that he was the son of a chicken?" Okay, it's a Talmudic joke. Let me give you what's happening. We have in the temple, we have no poultry in Jerusalem. We have in the temple that early in the morning before dawn, the crier of the temple is going to give a threefold cry. His threefold cry will be for the Kohanim, the priest, to go to the 12 ma'alot, the 12 steps that lead up into the temple building. That is the place that they will do the priestly blessing from that day. Then there's a pause. He waits a little while. Then he gives a cry for the Leva'im, the Levites, the Levitical choir, to go to the Dukkan. The Dukkan is the platform where the Levitical choir will stand. He waits a little while, and he gives the third cry. The third cry is for the Ma'amad. These are the men that will represent the 24 districts of Israel in saying the Shemoni Esrei, the Amidah, the prayers that they will report to the court of Israel. Now, we learn several things. First off, this establishes that the translator, when he saw the word gever, when he translated from Hebrew into Greek, he chose the wrong word. He chose a rooster. So it's a great tool when people say, "How do you know it was written in Hebrew?" This is proof. Number two, how many of you have been to Jerusalem? Number of you. How many of you went to the house of Caiaphas? You wasted your money. In Israel, your sites are set up on a scale. An A site means it happened here. Guaranteed 100% positive. A B site is you're not certain it happened here, but there's every proof to believe that it was. You cannot just prove it. A C site is It didn't happen here, but a church owns this property and they charge admission to go there. Okay? What we know is that the house of Caiaphas, the house of Annas, have to be close enough to the temple to hear the cry of the Gever. Are you understanding? The traditional house is too far away. We also learn from this that something of the style of the house of Caiaphas. We know that it was a peristyle house from the way that it's described. He was out in the courtyard where they had a fire set up. It was cold, and that's where he heard the Gever start to give his cries. The point is that it was not written in English, and it wasn't written in Greek. Why do we have these scriptures? I have the scriptures in my quest to want to know what God said. So I don't want to know what somebody said he said that didn't know what they were talking about. I want to go back and get this terminology so it makes sense. I'm going to blow this one up because you can't see it. This is from a Maksor. Now, a Maksor is a special prayer book for a festival. So this is a Maksor for the festival of Sukkot. So it should be particularly interesting if I can get it set up. Now, can you see the second line there? I'll read it to you. But this is a prayer called the Herald, Heralds, and Proclaims. So you just saw the word herald used for the choir of the temple. But in Jewish thought, there is a character in the liturgy that's called the herald. The herald. Any idea who that might be? Eliyahu. Elijah. The voice crying in the wilderness. Isaiah chapter 40. So there's a major prayer for the festival of Sukkot called the Herald, Heralds, and Proclaims. Second line. Oh, hark to the herald. This is first line. Oh, hark to the herald of sheer salvation. I hear my beloved. The voice is near. The voice is nigh. The beloved comes from Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. He comes with his myriads of hovering angels on the Mount of Olives to stand and cry. So the he right here is not the herald. The herald is saying he, the Messiah, is going to come to the Mount of Olives and cry. Now, when I became a believer, I purchased this Maksor. I purchased a Maksor. I purchased a Hertz Sidur. Right away, I read them almost in 2 days, from cover to cover. Couldn't put them down. Couldn't stop. When I came to this prayer, I went, wait a minute. I know in the New Testament that Yeshua comes to the Mount of Olives and he cries over the city of Jerusalem. But where did this guy that wrote this prayer get this? Where in Judaism did they get that the Messiah was prophesied to pray? In other words, it has to be in the Tanakh somewhere. Right? Are you understanding? So, let me unzoom this. And we're going to go to the next slide. We have the Gethsemane. Now, where does Gethsemane sit? Where does Gethsemane sit? Anybody? It's at the base of the Mount of Olives, right? It's down at the bottom of the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives, you have the Mount of Olives here. And the Temple Mount is here. Mount of Olives is higher. Let's do it this way. Mount of Olives is here. Temple Mount is here, Mount Moriah. And here's Mount Sion. And Mount Sion is not as high as the Mount of Olives, but it's higher than Mount Moriah. And you have the Kidron Valley here. And you have the Taropian Valley here. And then you have the Hinnom Valley over here on the west. Okay? So, Gethsemane makes no sense. Gethsemane translates as a wine press for oil. And it just doesn't make sense. So there is an example, though. We have one example where they did press olives. They pressed the olives in a wine press. There's one example where Gideon did this because he was afraid of the Midianites, and he did it in a cave. But that's a very, very rare occurrence. So, how many of you have ever heard of Dr. Plusser? Dr. Plusser, anything you can find from Dr. Plusser, you want to get, okay? This guy was phenomenal. He was an Orthodox Jew. He was one of the leading experts on the New Testament. One of his students thought, what if it was not Hebrew, Gethsemane, meaning Mount of Olives, or the wine press for olives, but rather that this was an example of loan words from Aramaic. And that it would be God Samane in Aramaic, which would mean the ascent of the olives. In other words, the base of the Mount of Olives. That's right where the Garden of Gethsemane is located. And we find when David fled from Absalom, that he went down the Kidron, and he started up the Mount of Olives, he turned and he wept over the city there. Okay? Everything comes into its place. Everything comes into its place. But the key to finding this is you have to go back into the Jewish text. You have to go back into the liturgy. You have to go back into the Mishnah and the Tosafta and the Talmud. You have to go back. Josephus. I use Josephus extensively. How many of you have the Josephus, a copy of Josephus? Okay? Now, you need Josephus, but you have the one volume, right? Anybody have one that's not a one? You got a four volume. Is it a Winston translation?
I can't remember.
Is it Little Green Books?
They're brown.
Are they small?
They're about like that.
Okay, those are going to be Winston. The Winston translation was done in the 1700s. When we work with the rabbis, we're not allowed to use that. They don't trust the text. They believe it's been tampered with. It also has major, major errors in it. If you can, if you're doing any type of real serious study on something, you want to go to what's called the Loeb translation. It is about 17 volumes. They're small, and I couldn't tell you how much they cost. They were given to me.
What's that name again?
Loeb. It's called the Loeb Classical Library. And that's what your scholars are going to use. Much better. And you'll have the Greek on one side, you'll have the English on another side. They're coming out with a new translation, and I think it's going to be eventually be about 15 volumes, but each volume is like $300 a piece. So, unless you're really serious, stay with the Loeb. But, you read it in English, then you look at it in Greek, then what we do is we go back and look at it in Hebrew. And there are several translations that are available in Hebrew because when it comes out in Hebrew, it comes from a different mindset. All right? Okay, so we're going to go forward. We have out of Luke 19, another place where that Yeshua wept over the city. And it says, now as he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it. He's saying, if he had known even you, especially this day, the things that make for your peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes, for days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you, and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation. Let me ask you, when did Yeshua say that? On his way to Jerusalem, when?
The last time.
Okay, so he's on the Mount of Olives. The last time. I want to know the season.
Spring.
No.
Passover.
He dies at Passover. Okay, he dies at Passover. So there's an expression that we have that is associated with Passover. From the book of Bereshit, from Genesis, it says that Yosef took an oath for the children of Israel, said, God will surely visit you. Let me read that to you out of the Tanakh, because it's translated another way. Both are correct. It's not a matter of poor translation here. It's just that there are two valid choices in Hebrew on how this can be translated. So it says, then Yosef adjured the children of Israel, saying, God will indeed remember you. So visit you, remember you, either translation is correct. The word in Hebrew is pakad. P-A-K-A-D. Pakad. God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. But wait a second, let me read that to you in Hebrew. Bereshit, or Genesis chapter 50, verse 25. Okay, now it says in English, even when we use the Orthodox translation in English, it says God will remember you. New King James, which is what I was using here, says God will visit you. Okay? But in Hebrew, now the word I told you for to visit, to remember, is pakod or pakad. It says, lemor pakod yifkod. Now, what, this is what we call a double. It repeats. This expression is going to be used again in chapter 19. What he has told them, Yosef made them promise when they left Egypt to take his bones, right? To take his coffin, to take his body. And the reason is that God will remember you. God will visit you. So let's go to the book of Shemot, or Exodus chapter 13. And we're going to go to verse 19. It says in the New King James, and Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him, for he placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry out my bones from here with you. Shemot chapter 13, verse 19. So when is Moshe leaving Egypt? Pesach. When does Yeshua say, you did not know the time of your visitation? Pesach. Okay, so in Shemot chapter 13, verse 19, out of the stone Tanakh, it says, Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him, for he had firmly adjured the children of Israel, saying, God will surely remember you, and you shall bring up my bones from here with you. So verse 19, the word is pekod, yivkod, in Hebrew, which would be translated, God will visit, will surely visit, or God will remember, will surely remember you. Okay, so let me see if I have another slide on this. No, we're going to wait a second here. The time of visitation, yes?
Dr. Kohlberger says, come to your aid. Is that correct or not?
I don't think so. Come to your aid?
Okay,
no.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't think so. But remember, I am a at-home scholar of Hebrew, okay? And that scholarship part is much smaller than the at-home part, all right? So in all cases, go to higher sources. But when you see terminology, it gives you a place that you can start to send out, okay? Like a dog, you get on the track of something. Basically, what the visitation means is the redemption. The redemption. The redemption is coming. That the redemption has started. So it becomes a very significant point that Yeshua is making. Why the double reference? All of you should know the passage on the tzitzit or the kanaf. Out of Zechariah 8:23, that in the last days, that 10 men from the nations will come and take hold of the corner or the kanaf of the garment of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you. Okay? But in Hebrew, it says, and they translate it that way in the Stone Tanakh, it says, we'll take hold, they will take hold. It's a double. It is said twice. Generally when you see it, this isn't the case all the time, but generally when you have a double, what it means is something will occur again. It is a prophecy, a significant prophecy. The way that I interpret Zechariah 8:23 is at the time of Yeshua, there was a great move among non-Jews called the God-fearers. Coming out of the woodwork, they were coming and grabbing hold of that which Hashem had given to the Jewish people. We have it happening again. It is the second time. We'll take hold. We're the second to take hold. So you'll say the first redemption was the Egyptian redemption. When they came out of Egypt, God had visited them and He's bringing them out of Egypt. When Yeshua came, it was the start of the greater messianic redemption. Are you understanding? All right. So we have when Yeshua comes over the mountains, and when He comes over the Mount of Olives, the people are going to be crying. This is where they are taking the Lulavim, and they're crying a Hosheinu, Hosheinu. You know the passage, and some cry to Him and say, "Forbid them, make them stop." And He answered, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out. So all of you people that have been over to Israel, did you go to the Mount of Olives? What do you remember most about the Mount of Olives? It's a cemetery. It is the largest Jewish cemetery, or it's the largest cemetery, in fact, in the world. The Muslims have the western side, which is Mount Moriah, the Kidron Valley. But the entire Mount of Olives is covered, for the most part, with tombs. With tombs. Why? Why do Jews prefer to be buried there? Where will the resurrection start? No. At Hebron. At the cave of Machpelah. But, unless you're part of the eight, you have to stand in line. Okay? Those eight get resurrected to the cave of Machpelah, and then they believe next they will come up from the Mount of Olives. There is even a belief, I don't know if this is true, but let's say that you were buried at a Jewish cemetery in West Point, Georgia. Okay? And the resurrection starts, there is a belief that they will tunnel underneath ground and come up at the Mount of Olives. Okay? So the desire is to be buried there. But what Yeshua was making a reference to, what He was making a reference to, is that the dead know who He is. The dead, even the stones would cry out and say that He was the Messiah. I want to turn to... We're going to get into specifically the festivals in a few moments. But I want you to go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I started a book a few years ago, about 3 years ago, I guess. And it was going well. Back in the 80s, I wrote this book called Rosh Hashanah and the Messianic Kingdom to Come. And this has a lot of the terminology in it, but what I wanted to do here, because a lot of you have been at the festivals many times, a lot of you have read this book and other books, and you're familiar with a lot of the more familiar terminology. So I wanted to hit ones you weren't familiar with. I wanted to hit stuff that you would not know from normal festival activities. So at any rate, I want you to go to 1 Thessalonians. Did I say 2nd? A friend of mine came over to my house. He said, you ought to write a sequel to this. You ought to write a book on prophecy and everything. So I started it. It was going real fast. It was going real well. And I was supposed to go and visit with one of the rabbis who was over from Jerusalem. And I was supposed to go see him, visit with him. And that day, my computer was stolen. So I lost it. And I never got back to it. But I had a publishing company that contacted me and they wanted to publish it. So I went up to meet with these guys and we sat down. And these guys are Christian publishing company. So I wanted to give them a sample of what it was going to be about. I talked for about 25 minutes and I looked down this table and these guys were sitting there and they had no earthly idea of what I was talking about. I mean, they zoned out. And the guy told me, he says, I have no idea what you just said. None whatsoever. So I want to take you through this passage. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night, nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night. Those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Yeshua the Messiah. Okay, so we read that. That is full of festival terminology. Almost every phrase in that entire passage comes from the liturgy for one of our festivals. And so you could read it and not make that association, which he had never done. Let's go back. I'm going to go actually to verse 13 of chapter 4. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you saw us others who have no escape. For if we believe that Yeshua died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Yeshua. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the shofar of God, the trumpet of God, and the dead in Messiah will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds. Thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore comfort one another with these words. Let's move forward and I'll come back to this. Here it is right here. In Hebrew, how do you say festivals? There's two ways. Moed. What's the plural? Moedim. What's the other word? Hag. What does hag mean? Circle, cycle, exactly. Okay, so how do you say seasons? You can cheat. Zamanim. Zamanim or Zaman is a season. Zamanim are the seasons. When Paul was writing in 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 and 2, it says, but concerning the Moedim and the Zamanim, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. In other words, you understand these things. You understand these things. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord, which the day of the Lord is the Shabbat of God, right? Did you know it is the name of a festival? Anybody? It is a name not only for Rosh Hashanah, but it is a name for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. There is a man. He's passed away now. His name is Sigmund Bohwinkel. He's referenced in the Encyclopedia Judaica under the articles of Eschatology and Rosh Hashanah. He wrote a work called The Psalms in Israel's Worship. Please go, hold your hand here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Please go to 1 Kings chapter 8. Verse 2. And the men of Israel assembled to King Shlomo at the festival in the month of Etanim, which is the seventh month. Okay? That is what we call Tishri today. That's the month we're in. In 1 Kings chapter 8, please go to verse 65. It says, "At that time, Shlomo held a festival and all Israel with him, a great congregation from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of the Egypt before the Lord our God, 7 days and seven more days, 14 days. On the eighth day, he sent the people away." All right, that doesn't make sense. Everybody comes at the festival of the seventh month. They're going to be there for 14 days keeping a festival. But on the eighth day, he sends them home. Do you understand the contradiction here? Please go to Nehemiah. I'm going to answer that. I'm not leaving you. Nehemiah or Nehemiah chapter 7, verse 73. Nehemiah 7:73. We'll go to the seaport of the verse. When the seventh month came, the children of Israel were in the cities. Now all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate. And they took Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the Torah of Moshe, which the Lord had commanded Israel. So Ezra the Kohen brought the Torah before the congregation of men and women and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. So what is that? That's Rosh Hashanah, okay? And we'll read, as we finish out the chapter, they will stay there through Sukkot. What Boethel discovered is that unlike Pesach, to Shavuot, you don't stay in Jerusalem until it's concluded. But when you would come, in the ancient custom was that you would come at the first of the month, and then you would stay through Shemini Atzeret, which is called the eighth day. So our passage, the people arrived in Jerusalem for the dedication of the temple and the keeping of the festivals on the first of Tishri. On the 8th of Tishri, they began the dedication of the temple. On the 10th of Tishri, they had Yom Kippur. On the 22nd of Tishri, it was Shemini Atzeret. 14 days from when they began the dedication, it's concluded, and he sends them home on the 8th day. Did you understand all that? What's that?
It's the eighth day of the festival, not the eighth day of the month.
Right, the eighth day of the festival. Okay? But, all of this, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot were collectively called Yom Hashem, the day of the Lord. It was a name for the festival. Major name of the festival. And again, you can check this out in Sigmund Boewinkel. Okay, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord, so immediately we have this prophesied day of the Lord, and we have our festivals of the fall are called the day of the Lord. And the primary one there is Rosh Hashanah itself. It so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains. Christianity calls the 7-year period of trouble what? The tribulation. You go into a room, I don't know about here in the United States, but I know in Israel, you go into a room with a bunch of Orthodox Jews, a bunch of rabbis, and somebody mentions the tribulation, you'll see people disappearing. I don't mean the rapture, I mean they are going out the doors and the windows. Okay? However, excuse me. If you mention the birth pains of the Messiah, the Hevelei Mashiach, the Hevelei Shel Mashiach, people will sit down. You will see the phrase frequently in the newspapers in Israel. It is a 7-year time period. So whenever Paul wrote, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, His Jewish audience and those that have become believers in Yeshua that were not Jews, who are following the Jewish pattern. They've grabbed hold of the kanaf. They are following the Jewish pattern. They know from the festivals and they know from the terminology that he's speaking of this 7-year period. The labor pains upon a pregnant woman and they shall not escape, but you, brethren, are not in darkness. Pay attention to the word darkness here. So that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light, sons of the day. That's become a understood expression from a document that was found at the Dead Sea. It's called the war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. When you went to Israel, if you went to the Israel Museum, they had the Shrine of the Book. And you have the white scroll cover that is outside, that it's like the lid to the pottery, but it's white. Across from it there is a black wall, and it's to represent the war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And everybody thinks, well, that's the Dead Sea eschatological group. It's not. It is an expression from Rosh Hashanah. The sons of light and the sons of darkness. There is a psalm that you recite every morning. Starting the first of Elul. What is the first of Elul? It is what? What?
Teshuvah.
Teshuvah. Exactly, Dean. And Teshuvah is what? Teshuvah is a season. Teshuvah is a season that lasts for how long?
40 days.
40 days. And it concludes on what? What's the last day of it? Yom Kippur. All right. We're loading ammunition in. So you recite a psalm every morning. What psalm is it?
27.
Psalm 27. How does it start off? The Lord is my light and my salvation. The readings of Rosh Hashanah. Have you read the Rosh Hashanah Maksor? All of you need to read the Maksor for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. You need to read the everyday Siddur from cover to cover. The Shabbat and festival Siddur from cover to cover. Because you're going to find the expressions of the epistles and the expressions of Yeshua are going to be found in here. These writers did not take this from the New Testament. Yeshua, Paul, the other writers were using that terminology to express we are reading a book that we do not know what we're reading because we're reading it like I talk to kids about apps. Okay? You want to understand. And when I go through the festivals, when I go through the liturgy, I will sit there. You should see my Yom Kippur Maksor. It's got little yellow sticky pads all over the place. Because I'll read something, my hair stands up on the back of my neck. Because now you can see, now you can understand. Okay, so it says, but you brethren are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light, sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. Then we call this the armor, the spiritual armor, so forth and so forth. Where else is that mentioned in the New Testament? Ephesians, very good, excellent. From Isaiah chapter 59. This is a reading. This is a reading, and portions of this are still in the Maksor to this day. But this is an ancient reading for Rosh Hashanah. The way of peace they have not known. This is Isaiah 59 verse 8. The way of peace they have not known. Remember the peace and safety when they cry out peace and safety? Sudden destruction will fall upon them. The way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that away shall not know peace. Therefore justice is far from us. nor does righteousness overtake us. Before I go any further, give me some names for Rosh Hashanah.
Day of shouting.
I didn't hear.
Day of shouting.
Day of shouting. Okay, Yom HaTorah. Okay? Day of shouting, and that also means the day of blowing a trumpet. Okay? Yom HaTorah. Okay?
Day of the awakening blast.
And that's the same thing. Yom HaTorah. Another one? What?
Hadid.
Yom Hadid. What does that mean? Day of judgment. Day of judgment. Give me another one. That is an expression that is definitely linked to Rosh Hashanah, the day that no man knows. All right? But I need a title. Yom HaKiseh, the day of the concealed moon, or the day of the throne. All right? Another one. Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance. Okay? So,
would that also be a Rosh Hashanah?
Rosh Hashanah, yes, the new moon. Okay, so here we have an aspect of judgment, the day of judgment. There is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that away shall not know peace. Therefore, justice is far from us, nor does righteousness overtake us. We look for light, but there is darkness. For brightness, but we walk in blackness. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday. As at twilight, we're as dead men in desolate places. And I always love this one. This is an early morning passage. We all growl like bears. Moan sadly like doves. We look for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but is far from us. Dropping down to verse 17. For he, it talks about the arm of the Lord. It says, for he put on righteousness as a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing, and was clad with zeal as a cloak. The text, question, in Jewish theology, in Jewish eschatology, when will the resurrection occur?
Last trump.
That is a name. That is a name for a festival. What is it? Which festival? It's Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah. Let me tell you a story. When I became a believer, now I was raised in a Baptist church, and my mother made sure that we went to church every Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night. We did not think of going to church without having read your Sunday school lesson. Or your training union. I mean, that was big trouble. Big trouble. And it was, you know, it wasn't a fake thing. It was something that we did. It was our life. But I didn't become a believer until I was 28 years old. So I was around it. I was in the midst of it. I could talk it. And I even believed I was a believer. But I became a believer when I was 28. And almost immediately, God started leading me down this path. And so, I decided not to do Easter. I did a Passover, and Passover blew me away. Crummiest Passover I ever did in my life. Because I didn't know anything. But, it blew me away. So, I got a book from my local library, which was a commentary on the Maksor for Rosh Hashanah. And I'm reading through this book, and the guy is talking about that at the last trump, the dead, the righteous dead, will be raised. And I go, wow, he must have read 1 Corinthians 15. He borrowed that from Paul. Okay? And then realized, that's ridiculous. But this must be terminology. Terminology for the festivals. We found out that the first trump was the trump of Shavuot. Shavuot, when God gave the Torah to Israel, and made a betrothal, a shitrei or a seed with Israel at that time. And that was, in rabbinics, is understood to be the ram of the Akedah. You know what the Akedah is? The binding of the sacrifice on Mount Moriah where Yitzhak was taken and a ram was caught in the thicket. How many horns does a ram have? Two. So the weaker horn is the left horn, and that was the horn of Shavuot. The right horn is the Messianic horn. The Messianic horn is called the last trump, because it's the last horn on the head. You have another trump that is called the trump of Yom Kippur. And is at the end of Yom Kippur, at the Neilah service, Tikiah HaGedolah, a long blast of the shofar is sounded. And that's called the Great Shofar. Okay, so we have that the dead will be raised, the righteous dead will be raised at Rosh Hashanah. If you remember 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it went into the resurrection of the righteous, the catching away of the living righteous, and then it went into, but you have no need that you... But concerning the times and the season, but concerning the Moedim and the Zamanim, you have no need that I write to you. And he goes on down right into a text from Isaiah 59. I submit to you that Paul wrote the book of 1 Thessalonians at the season of Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, either coming up to it or in the midst of it. Also, the book of Ephesians. The book of Ephesians is written in the terminology and in the themes, the ideas expressed in Rosh Hashanah. Here, we have from Ephesians chapter 5. Therefore he says, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Messiah will give you light. That's Ephesians 5:14. How many of you have the Rosh Hashanah Maksor from Art Scroll? Just a couple of you? Oh, you need this book. You need this book. And you can get it in the interlinear, which is great, or you can just get the regular. But in the beginning, in the introduction, it's going to give you the 10 reasons for the blowing of the shofar. Right before it, it's going to quote a prayer that Moses Maimonides put in Mishnah Torah. This prayer is a prayer that he claims came from the temple at the time of Rosh Hashanah. And it is worded almost verbatim with what we have in Ephesians 5, verse 14. What I'm submitting to you is that Paul took a prayer in writing to the Ephesians that was associated with Rosh Hashanah, and we can trace it to the temple. Arise becomes a key phrase that we have throughout the Scriptures, to arise or to awake. If you buy a Jewish desk calendar, or a book, I don't mean the kind that you flip over just the pages, I'm talking about the little books that you open up on an appointment calendar. If you buy one for a year, it will always have, almost always, all the ones I've seen will have either awake or arise several times in there, because that is terminology associated with the resurrection of the dead, and it is terminology that you find in the in Rosh Hashanah. We find these phrases, awake and arise, throughout the Tanakh. I'm going to show you some in a few minutes. Alright, we drop down to verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. We'll just read a little bit of it, then go on. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Messiah is head of the Kahal. Okay, I don't mean to offend anybody here. I have 3 minutes. I won't have time to offend anybody real bad. I don't consider myself a Christian. Okay? I believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. Okay? I believe that He is, that the redemption was provided through Him. But I don't consider myself a Christian, because I believe that Christianity became a Frankenstein's monster. And but I consider myself a part of the Kahal of God. I don't like the terminology church, because it has this connotation that goes with it, and a mindset. So, why at Rosh Hashanah, why in Ephesians, if he's writing at Rosh Hashanah, does he go into the theme of wives, submit to your husbands as Messiah has to the Kahal? Because one of your Psalms you read at Rosh Hashanah is Psalm 145. You need to read the liturgy. You need to read it. You need to read it. You need to read it. You need to be able to go like this and call off what Psalms are read at different festivals, at different services, at different times in the morning. Because every part of it was given by Hashem in order to instruct us so that we could see and read this, and it would not be like talking to a kid about apps. Okay? So, Psalm 145 is the coronation of the Messiah and the wedding of the Messiah. And the wedding of the Messiah is a theme of Rosh Hashanah. So it has all this thing. Why? Submit yourselves to your husbands. Then it goes on. It says, we're all members of His body. And since this is a great mystery or so, but I speak concerning Messiah and the Kahal. Then, Ephesians chapter 6, he goes into, put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Again, this terminology, this letter, was based in Isaiah 59, which was based in the festival of Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So we've already been over this. I want to show you something real quick. Debbie mentioned that one of the names of Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaKisei. It comes from Psalm 81 verse 4. Let me blow this up. I'm down to probably 15 seconds. Okay. I'm not good at this. All right. The first of Tishrei is also called Yom HaKisei, Day of Concealment. I want to get this verse for you. It says, sound the shofar, the ram's horn. I'll read it. Oh, I can't. The ram's horn. At the concealed time for our festival, at the new moon, at the concealed time of our festival day. It is mistranslated in almost all of our translations. It is Hebrew parallelism. And I'll read it to you real quick out of the New King James, and then we'll have to close here. Psalm 81, verse 4. This is read in every single service of Rosh Hashanah. It's verse 3, by the way, if you're using a non-Jewish publication, verse 4 in Hebrew Tanakh. Here it says, blow the shofar at the time of the new moon, at the full moon, on our solemn feast day. That doesn't make sense. The new moon's the first of the month, the full moon's the 15th of the month. He says, Yom HaKisei, which means concealed. The new moon, you can't see the moon. It's concealed. But Kisei in Hebrew also is the word for the throne. The throne had a canopy over it. And that's why it was called. That's why the canopy made the throne, or in Hebrew today, a modern chair, is called kisei. Okay? But, why is that important? Because Rosh Hashanah is the time of the coronation of the Messiah. Your themes come out as you go through. Sorry we didn't have more time, but we didn't have more time.